Thank you for taking the ride on the Freedom Train Podcast series. I'm your host, Joseph Ward, and always ride with me is my good homie, Mr. Patrick Irvin. Hey, remember, the Freedom Train is brought to you by PAX Inc. That's PACTSINC. And PAX Inc. is a black development organization aimed at developing the black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. For more information, make sure you visit the website at www.pactsinc.org. That way, you can learn more about the organization, its members, the codes of conduct, how to get more involved with the organization, learn more about the sports package and the sports program that's put together. Hover your mouse over the learning tab, over the more tab, excuse me, then you'll see a drop-down box where it says Learning Center in store. Hover your mouse over the Learning Center, you see all the resources you have, and, you know, click on that store and buy yourself something. And once again, the website is www.pactsinc.org, an organization that is working hard in a community for you. You heard me? And while you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com. That way you can learn more about me. I know you want to know about me. I know you want to know about my, more about me. You know what I'm talking about? You can learn about me. You can learn about Pat, too, I guess. Enigma September. All the plethora of shows. Why well, say all the plethora? I don't know. But all the shows that we got on the network right here at www.freedomtrainradio.com, freedomtrainradio.com, the realest podcast network ever in history. And, you know, it's all because of me. It ain't got nothing to do with Pat. It's all because of me. Ain't that right, Pat?
Right. I would agree with that. Totally.
Yeah, dog. Like, tell them what you do. Nothing. Right.
Right. Absolutely nothing.
No, I'm talking about just be out here playing Jack Stones. Remember that game?
Nah. Is that like hopscotch?
You don't remember Jack Stones?
Nah.
You don't remember you bounced the ball, you had the little spiky looking things. You bounced the ball,
oh,
and before the ball come down, you got to snatch them off the floor.
We just call it the Jacks.
Yeah, Jacks. Well, Jacks, man, come on. Come on, man. You're supposed to be able to use context cues, man.
Well, you know, Jack Stones, you know, I'm fine. People got all kinds of other names for other things, so you can't make assumptions, you know what I'm saying?
Pat, you're supposed to at least take a shot.
Okay.
That's how you do, bro. That's how you do, bro.
You know, I'm a passer. I'm not a shooter.
I, Ricky Rubio.
How I prefer that? LeBron James.
How about you? Not LeBron James. You Ricky Rubio.
I'm LeBron James because I'm the GOAT, and I'm no. I don't have a shoot first mentality. I have a pass first mentality because I'm trying to set up the rest of the team to make the whole squad better.
So you saying you? So you saying in light of all that, you still average 27? That's what you're saying,
Nate.
Man, look here, Pat.
Oh,
I dunk on you, Pat.
Probably would. I mean, okay. Like LeBron James, I also don't play no defense. Oh,
Well, LeBron can play defense. In his 17th year, he shouldn't be that great at defense, but he's still better than most of the league. So
I didn't
he's still
you
better.
I just said, like LeBron
I know,
James,
I'm just,
I don't play defense.
You got to let me finish. This was aimed at Skip Bayless. Because
oh,
he just
go
be
ahead.
Randomly going at
get
okay?
on his eye. Get
if
on
he,
his eye.
Since he randomly going LeBron, I'm just randomly going at Skip Bayless, old Andrew Jackson looking ass.
Tell him about the gun line ball. Get him.
Tell him about it, Skip Bayless. No, he got a LeBron James pajama set in his closet. Yeah,
get him.
So
what we got.
So, you know, month of August, and in August, we like to make sure we pay attention to mental health within the black community, do our best to bring more awareness, more resources, and appreciate Professor Carl Tone Jones for being on the show with me last week. You hear me? So, This week, following up, Pat is back. Pat, oh yeah, hold up, Pat. Hold up, Pat. Hold up, Pat. We got a. Hey, y'all give a round of applause. Pat, our new daddy. He a new daddy. Yeah. Give it up for him. Pat. Shoot it up, 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 Pat.
Damn it.
There you go. So, once again, congratulations, my brother, on being a new daddy.
Word.
You know what I'm talking
Appreciate
about?
You. Digital hey, cigars hey. For everybody.
You know what I'm talking about? Good aim, my brother. Good aim.
You know, we go to target practice. We take that serious.
Ain't supposed to scream thug life and empty the pill. You know what I'm talking about? But I wanted to say it. I wanted to do that for you. But, you know, Mental Health Awareness Month. And like I said, thank you. Shout out to PC for coming on the show last week. And welcome back to the Freedom Train podcast series, my brother. And, man, let's get into it. So things we're going to talk about is suicide rates in the African-American community or the black community, however you want to call it. So suicide rates among black people. We'll talk about that. We want to differentiate. We want to break down PTSD and PTSS. We've talked about it in the past, but we don't want to just assume that people know what they are. So we're going to go more into what PTSD and PTSS is and how it's caused. Also, we're talking about, what's that third topic? Life expectancy, my bad. Mental health, the effects of mental health on life expectancy with people in black community as well. So we think these are three topics that should be talked about and need to be talked about. So we're talking about them. Why? Because we can, right? There you go.
Right.
Yeah, man. So I'm going to start with the suicide rates. And I want to start with this question for you, Pat. Why did you think it was important for us to discuss suicide rates within the black community?
Well, I mean, because they're rising. They're going up, you know, and they're going up rapidly. And obviously white people are still more likely to commit suicide as a whole. You know, 70% of suicides are committed by middle-aged white men. Shout out to Epstein. But amongst the black community, those numbers are rising. And what's even more troubling is that they're rising with the younger generations, the youth. Teenage black children and young pre-9, pre-10, or 6 to 9, I believe it is. And then it jumps again once you get to high school. It levels out, then it jumps again once they get to high school. But in these age brackets, according to some of the things I've been looking at for a while now, the black suicide rate for young children and for teenagers is either right next to whites in the case of teenagers, where it's slightly above, or in the case of young children, where it's almost twice as high. So, you know, you're talking about a light being snuffed out before it even gets a chance to truly shine bright, before it fully gets a chance to illuminate the world with potential brilliance. And that's something that we got to take root of, and it's something that as adults, you know, one of our responsibilities is to be a caretaker or a steward for the next generation. And that means that if the next generation is turning out its own lights, that's something that we have to definitely be aware of and do our best to figure out and minimize what's going on.
Right. Yeah, because suicide rates have risen according to a lot of the information that I've come across. You know, we was talking before the show, so let me readjust some of the numbers that we were saying before, that was talked about before the show. So it says the study, which was published in the Journal of Community Health, found the rate of suicide death among young black males increased by 60% from 2001 through 2017. Researchers documented that a 182% increase in the rate of suicide deaths among young black females during that same period. So Georgia had the highest rate in the nation at 5.8 per 100,000 people between 2015 and 2017, followed by Texas, Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. So just kind of want to put that out there for a baseline of statistics. Also for another baseline of statistics between, according to about, what's this, African Foundation for Suicide, oh, excuse me, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. So according to this website, suicide rates by ethnicity from 2000 to 2016. So 2000 for blacks, it was 5.52%. So now it's 6.61. So the rate, not percent, but the rate went from 5.52 to 6.61. So another question, and I'll answer this too, but I want to throw it to you first. What do you think is contributing to the increased rate in suicides within the black community, especially amongst our teens, our middle school age and teens?
Well, I got a bunch of different ideas, and you know, we both know that it's hard to narrow it down to one thing. There aren't very many studies, real studies, that have been confirmed by duplicate studies and duplicate analysis or even a meta-analysis of what's out there. There's just very little information available that really delves into why. So I want to put out that caveat that, everybody's speculating right now. Nobody knows. And two, we aren't trained professionals at, diagnosing what could cause suicide or anything like that. So I want to lay both those out and just put it at the feet. While I do a lot of reading and research and blah, 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 I don't have no certificates and no pieces of paper that says that I'm certified to make any sort of diagnosis or any sort of whatever. So after I put those two out there, I want to say, I think when you look at the numbers, the suicide rates for blacks aged 15 to 34 is higher than it's been in 50 years, more than 50 years, going back to the 1970s. And to me, I think, especially when you're dealing with young kids whose social environment is so critical to their mental health and well-being, honestly, I start to look at the social situations that children find themselves in nowadays that previously they might not have found themselves in. The superficial assimilation, the superficial mingling of the races without fixing the undercurrent of negativity and animosity that we know as racism. I think kids are acutely sensitive to those things, and the fact that nobody's talking about it and nobody's putting word to it, and they're being made to feel like they should feel good about being placed in situations that they deem as better, or about being placed in situations where they're surrounded by people that don't look like them, don't think like them, don't have the same background or the same stressors. They're being told that being in these situations is better for them. I think all of that builds up a lot of stress. And for a child with no outlet, it becomes hard to manage that stress. And so I think when you put a kid in that situation, and then they start to experience some of the social pressures as their peers, their white peers grow up and become a little bit more savvy and a little bit more cruel, but also a little bit more refined in how they approach people that aren't like them. I think there is a natural tendency, there's going to be an outlet. You know, there's going to be a kid that would rather just end it all than deal with another day of the types of things that they're dealing with, because they aren't being equipped to deal with those things. They're being told that they should be happy that they're in these spaces, and nobody's talking to them about the larger picture. And you know, I just think, I'm going to be blunt. We got to get black kids in black spaces and allow them to be confident and comfortable in those spaces, in their skin. And until we do that, the more we try to get black kids to be amicable amenable, accepted, receptive of being the only black person in the environment, and to somehow feel like they're being rewarded by being in this place and not talking to them about the larger social issues, I feel like that's what's one of the driving factors of the youth suicide rates in the black community. And I feel like until we get that under control, it's going to continue to rise. I don't view it as a coincidence that the suicide rates for black teens started going, for black kids started going up after the civil rights movement.
Well, I would say, you know, and just my opinion, no real research, just, you know, off of vague, well, I ain't gonna say vague, but limited observation. I would say two of the things that would come to mind, and I'm not saying these are the only two, but just two things that would come to mind would be unresolved traumatic stuff that we do on a regular basis to each other in the black community that's been passed down from generation to generation. If you want to call it generational curses, call it that. There's a lot of unresolved stuff. And for black women specifically, even though all black people do it, but it seems like black women have to deal with a lot more shifting. And when I say shifting, I mean exactly what Pat was saying, but I think it's a little more pronounced for black women, is having to shift the way you walk, talk, act, and think from space to space. So if you work in the white world, you can't be yourself. And then when you get home, you got to shift to this, and that. So it's like, especially for black women, having to shift those things, but also compounded with that for black women specifically is social pressures and things, even though we all deal with it. But I still would go back to the unresolved generational issues that we deal with on a regular basis. You know, at the root of it is racism. We understand that the root of it is racism. But then racism, sexism, classism, all these other isms that we have to deal with on a regular basis, which will cause PTSD, which is still laced with PTSS, and we're going to break those down next. But it's laced with those things. And also our historical unwillingness mixed with historical ignorance about mental health. And I don't mean ignorance in a bad way. I mean we're just not knowing about mental health care. But then some who do know still refuse it, but not all. Some do. But also lack of resources, lack of mental health resources or lack of understanding of mental health resources, compounded with the lack of mental health professionals who could be on our side. I mean, I try to remind people that the mental health industry, the mental health, the whole lane in the world of mental health has its roots in racism and oppression with white people experimenting on black people. So, you know, there's still that distrust that black people have with the whole healthcare system, whether it's mental health, physical health, psychological health, all of these different things, because the way, you know, the foundation of a lot of these institutions. But we have to really start looking at suicide, and it's more than just a white people thing. Because when we were teenagers, when we were young, when we heard about suicide, it was white people. And not to say that black people wasn't committing suicide, but when we heard about it, it was white people. So we always said, well, that's a white thing. We always looked at it as that's a white people thing. Black people are not committing suicide. But another thing you and I was talking before the show started is, even though you've encountered more people than not, black people who we know who committed suicide. And looking at things now, looking at social media and on the news, we see it feels like once a month a new black child is committing suicide. So we have to really start reevaluating how we exist as black people in America, because we can't just go off of how we normally did it, because it's not working and things are compounding. You know what I'm saying? Like suicide rates are literally rising. We can see those. You see the rates rise, and then we talk about methods of suicide. The most effective method is using firearms. The next is suffocation. The next is poisoning. And then there's this other category that's labeled other, so that could be some of everything. But We know the most lethal method is using firearms, but we know from what we've seen in the media that a lot of our children been hanging themselves and all these things. But also putting your, like, well, I ain't gonna say also, but going back to putting your child in white spaces, having your child in a white space where they can't be their authentic black self, and then that's pressure on them and stress on them, and then if they're in those white spaces being bullied. The way we look at bullying and all those different things, it's different now. Things are different. Even though we like to, some of us are still stuck in the 90s. And I will admit I am partially still stuck in the 90s because I sometimes ask myself and I ask other people, how does bullying lead to suicide? Because, you know, we've seen bullying, we've been bullied, we've bullied all those different things. But then again, we still have to look at it. These kids ain't us. And if it's happening, then we got to pay more attention to it and look at it different and take our traditional feelings out of it and really, really start taking plans of actions to prevent these things from happening rather than sitting back and waiting on them to happen.
I think you touched on a couple of real good things. One of them was bullying. And I'm of that same mind that you mentioned where I'm stuck in a different era. But one of the things I've recognized, especially the more I get involved with other kids, is that these kids are more socially isolated than we were. You know, a lot of them, they have their networks, but I honestly feel like social media, the internet, chat apps, text apps, all of those things, they cause kids to have a superficial connection with one another. And when you have a superficial connection, you can't really provide that deep level support that a person might need when they're dealing with a traumatic social event. So, like, you know, for instance, me and Joe, so we grew up together and we were best friends. We hang out all of the time, and I'm going through something at school with another kid who's really making my life difficult. Because I have that deep emotional connection with Joe, he can comfort me. You know, you could stand in that space, you know, kind of be that wall to keep me from going over the edge because we have that relationship built over real experiences.
But not to cut you off, but let's just be real, though, too. And I'm not saying this should happen, but I'm just being realistic about us and not specific. We would have handled it differently because I probably would have asked you, you want to jump them?
Well, right. But that's also, that goes into having that real-world connection where, you know, this person is not only willing to stand in the gap to keep you from hurting yourself, but they're also willing to step up and protect you if you need to be protected. You know, they're also able to provide other outlets. Like when we were growing up getting bullied, we talk about this all the time, there was always this kind of unwritten rule that when you saw things getting serious, somebody would step in, at least growing up in the hood. Somebody would be like, hey, man, leave that man alone before he whop your ass.
Yeah.
You know, something like that would be said. And if we saw that it was going really bad, somebody would step in and start kind of busting on the bully to just kind of,
you
know, de-stress, detangle the situation because it was all fun and games. A lot of these kids nowadays, they don't have those deep social connections, those empathetic bonds, those sympathetic views. They'll see a kid getting bullied, and even if they're not participating, they'll just let it continue to ride out. And the only social network that this kid has is a digital one. He doesn't have any real-world counterparts that he can really react with or interact with that can sort of relieve some of that stress or provide some of that deeper emotional support that's necessary. So there's nothing there to keep him from going over the cliff. Because we all know that when you're really down on yourself, when you're really feeling bad, a digital support network is not enough. Like your Facebook friends telling you to keep your head up, it doesn't feel the same as somebody really in your space connecting with you and telling you to keep your head up in the real world. So I think that's another component that we're missing is these kids are not connected the same way that we were connected. But, you know, you talked about also about genetic curses, and that's real. You know, that's where I go back to my study on epigenetics. You know, when we start talking about epigenetics and how behavioral traits and conditions and things of that nature, trauma, is passed down genetically from parents to children. And the trauma that a grandmother went through or a grandfather went through can be expressed in the child, in the behavior, in the genes of their grandchildren. And that's something that's very real, not even on, and even to a deeper level. You know, mental health is influenced by so many different things, even something like gut biome, the bacteria living inside of your body. The bacteria living inside and on your body have been shown, there are numerous studies now that show that the makeup of these bacteria do affect mood and behavior. And so that's when you start getting into all kinds of other things that are happening on a biochemical level that are affecting us mentally and where we are. And those things could get thrown out of whack by various different things that at one point we thought were healthy, like getting enemas, you know, or various other things that we might do to cleanse our bodies, and we end up destroying most of the good bacteria, and bad bacteria replicates faster than good bacteria, so we leave a void that's filled with bacteria that's not necessarily beneficial for us. So we can, not trying to go too far into a tangent, but just this suicide thing is important, it's deep. Yes, white people do commit suicide at twice the clip of black people. But the problem with that is there's a lot more of them, and they're committing suicide older. When you start getting the ages down, we meet them and then eventually pass them. And that means that it's even more traumatic when a black person does commit suicide, because it's usually a child or a young adult. It ain't some 40, 50-year-old man that's lived his life, you know, some dude that's had a career, has grown children, blah, 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 has more than likely already made his impact on the world. And I'm not trying to minimize anybody committing suicide at any age, but I think we can all agree that it's a lot more tragic when a 9 or 10-year-old commits suicide versus a 40 or a 50-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's always going to be more tragic because, you know, our people are old, they have so much more life to live and all those things. But all suicides in our community are traumatic. Every last one of them. I think we should treat them all as traumatic situations.
Right.
You know, I understand the sentiment that people have where this person has so much life to live. Yes. We all have so much life to live, but let's get to the point to where our mindset is, okay, well, how can we prevent this from happening in the future? You know, because even when we transition to PTSD and PTSS, that comes with the package of the generational stuff. And I just feel like, we're here with suicides because a lot of things have been ignored.
I agree.
We're supposed to just be tough. Suck that shit up. Stop all that goddamn crying. Ain't nothing wrong with you. You know, when I was your age, we was doing this. And when I was your age, we were doing that. Like, we don't express our feelings. And I think we're doing a better job of it now. But for the most part, the black community hasn't really made that total transition that the way that we like to present that we have. It just hasn't happened. That's why we're here talking about what we're talking about. The black community is still 20 years behind, especially like the white community and other communities, as far as getting out of these boxes, these unhealthy cycles that have been holding our community back, whether it's sex, whether it's mental health, whether it's physical health, all these different things. Like, it's okay for black people to evolve. And that's what I want us to understand. It's okay for us to evolve. We can still be our authentic black selves, and we can evolve as black people. And evolution doesn't mean we have to pick up what other people do as far as culturally. But at the same time, mental health is something that's intercultural. You know, it's not something that only white people do. Like, black people have been taking care of mental health, our mental health. We had mental health issues, and we're taking care of mental health, we're doing different things before white contact. We've lost that history and connection to ourselves. We believe we didn't do these things. No, black people, we took care of ourselves before white contact. after white contact, we forgot who we were. But we took care of ourselves. We need to get back to taking care of ourselves.
Yeah, I think you're a little bit more optimistic than me, and that's standard procedure, actually. Because I don't feel like we've made very much progress, if at all. The man box still remains very much intact. And it's largely the same as it was back when my dad was growing up. Now, the types of acceptable career fields may have shifted, but the expectation of what a man is has not changed very much.
But there are a lot more spaces for men to get out of the man box, though, than existed when your father, when my dad and your dad were young.
I agree with that either, though, because the spaces that we've created, and this goes back to one, you know, when we start talking about solutions, which I guess we can talk about at any point. One of the problems that we have is when we create, and not all, because I know you're a part of Men Can Stop Rape and a couple other groups that might do different, but I know a lot of the groups that I've seen, been in, and been a part of, the safe space is a superficial safe space. It's a space where you can open up to a point. You can't open up totally. Now, you can, in these spaces, you can be a little bit more of a human than you could if say a woman was around, but you can't be a total human. There's still boundaries in place where you still have to be a man, and that means certain emotional displays aren't permitted for very long. You know, we give you 5 seconds and 3 tears to express any sort of sorrow. You give me 4 tears or you carry on for more than 5 seconds, we got an issue, man. Straighten up. Toughen up, man. Get it right. You know, and it's the same with the work that's done in our homes. You know, the older a child gets, especially a boy child, but even nowadays a girl child too, because they're expected to be these pillars of strength in the community. You know, you start out as a kid with unlimited cries. You can cry however many times you want. The older you get, the lower that number gets. And to the point where, you know, you're a teenage boy, you don't have no more cries. You know, you might have 1 or 2 for the next, for a 5 or 10 year stretch. And a woman might have maybe 5 or 6 for that same stretch of time. So I don't necessarily feel like there are more spaces for a man to be a human on a real level. I feel like it's all superficial, but I do feel like those spaces are necessary in order to solve the problem. We need spaces where a man can be a human,
I don't know, Pat,
and a woman can be a human.
I don't know, Pat. We're going to disagree on this one, because I do think it's more spaces. And I will say from my experiences in these spaces that have been created for men, It's been very good. It's been very open. It's been very cleansing. And I know, and I've been in spaces where the people who created the spaces had training and their certifications and everything they needed in mental health. So those spaces were specific. Now, I know my spaces are different. The spaces that I existed in are different. So I can't speak about other people's spaces, but ones that I've been in, no. We've had these men and boys come out and tell some things and deal with things that they've never dealt with before, and it was all met with love. You know, everything was given time. I mean, I get where you're coming from, but we're gonna have to disagree on, you know, the fact that whether they happen or not. I mean, and that's cool too. But I don't feel like overall we've made great strides, but I do feel like it's a lot more spaces, and some men, More than was in the past, are a little more conscious about those things than it was in the past. So,
you know why I'm a, and it's not that it's a big disagreement, because it's subjective. Your experiences lend you one way, my experiences lend me another way. But I can say this: a couple of years ago, when I first started talking to my dad about these things, he went to FAMU, and his brothers all pledged different fraternities or whatever, but they would all talk about the same things we're talking about now, the need to create safe spaces for men. And he told me that they were having these same conversations when he was in college, you know, 30 years ago, about creating these safe spaces, creating these blah, blah, blah spaces, and how a couple people even created the spaces. And so that's where I say I don't feel like we've made a whole lot of progress, because we're still having the same conversations that my dad told me that he was having with his friends and that they were having in fraternities all over the country 30 years ago, 40 years ago. So that's where I'm getting at. Now, has the thinking shifted? I would agree with you in that. The thinking has shifted a bit. But I guess where we disagree is I don't believe that the action has really been put into play enough for me to say that there's progress. And you're saying that you do believe that there has been progress.
I mean, I do believe there's progress. I believe the environment is better now to actually create the space, to do more than just talk about the spaces, to actually create the spaces, and then to have the spaces be healthy. Now, whether or not there's a drastic change, I can't say that I agree that there's a drastic change, but I do feel that there's change. I do feel like there's progress with black men. I do see black men in certain spaces operating a bit differently. But then again, you know, that goes to exposure and privilege, because what I'm talking about is mostly what I would see on FAMU or FSU campus. But if I go into the hood, it ain't like that. So there is progress, but there isn't drastic progress.
I got you.
So. But yeah, man, but suicide rates in black community, it is risen. It's there, and they continue to rise. So we have to become active participants within our community and not just sleep on mental health. Incorporate mental health into the different things that we do within the community, our activities, our interactions with each other, and not just look over it. Let's do better, people. Let's do better. We want to bring attention to it so we can do better. All right, so transition to talking about PTSD and PTSS, right? Post-traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic slave syndrome, right? And when I first learned about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, I learned about PTSD in the form of people coming back from the war, from different types of war, who had a traumatic situation, and they don't operate the same. You know, you saw it in movies and all those other things. Never thought of PTSD as something that can exist outside of combat until I got older and started really understanding what trauma was. So post-traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic slave syndrome. So post-traumatic slave syndrome is one of the things Pat and I was just talking about, the generational trauma that we're still harboring from slavery. A lot of the ills from slavery that happened, I guess, if you will, generational curses from slavery that happened to us, we've never gotten over. We never really healed from these things. So we still have these disorders that exist. The historical one is PTSS. So just think about post-traumatic slave syndrome as our historical PTSD, and PTSD as something that's currently still going on and something that's moving forward to the future. But PTSS is always there with us, because these are things that we aren't necessarily dealing with, as we've been saying in the first segment. So how do we deal with PTSD and PTSS, Pat?
Professional help. I mean, PTSD is something that we need trained professionals to deal with.
Right.
And I think I have PTSD not only from my time in the military, but also from several incidents that happened both before and after my time in the military. And I have started to reach out to people and see people about that. And a lot of the initial reports are very confirmational in that, you know, I might have something. And there's no way to get around that. You need help because some of the things that I'm dealing with, some of the things that friends of mine are dealing with are not things that a regular person can walk you through. Like, these are serious. You're talking about invasive memories that just spawn, just pop up. You know, you just pop in your head. And it's not like you're there where you don't know where you are. It's just that the memory carries such an intense emotion that you're prone to an emotional outburst or erratic behavior in that moment. In order, for me anyways, in order to just deal with the memory. You're talking about people that, you know, become reclusive. They don't want to, they just don't want to interact, which could get really in, really gets in the way of any friend that wants to try to help them anyways, because they don't want to interact. You know, you're talking about all sorts of changes in the way people think and behave, you know, going emotionally numb. Which can also be a sign of depression, not feeling anything, which is something I think a lot of black people are dealing with nowadays, where maybe they don't have PTSD, but they've gone emotionally numb to a lot of the things that's happening around us. And look, anytime you can witness, experience, or hear about something as negative as a tragic death and not be moved one way or another, there is an emotional problem there. I'm not saying it's big or small. I'm just saying there's a problem there that needs to be looked at and considered, because the loss of human life should always move us. But, you know, you need professional help to deal with that. Now, when it comes to post-traumatic slave syndrome, PTSS, we need institutions to deal with that.
Yeah.
We don't, that's not something where we could just have a community therapist come out and just blah, blah. No, you need institutions that are going to rework and reshape the way you deal with the world, and that are going to reprogram you in your world outlook. That's going to reshape you, create new experiences, create new outlooks, create new interactions, and create new genetic markers for you to pass down to your children, while simultaneously stripping away the old markers filled with trauma and abuse and various other things. So we need a therapist to deal with the individuals. We need some sort of professional psychologist, therapist, psychiatrist, counselor, somebody trained to deal with the PTSD that we have as a community, and that needs to be dealt with on an individual level. But then we need institutions that are going to deal with the PTSS, and that has to happen on a cultural or a collective level, on a group level. Just my opinion.
Right. Now, I feel you. Dr. And you know I got a crush on her, too. Dr. Joy DeGruy wrote a book in 2000. I didn't know it came out in 2005, but published a book in 2005, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome. Now, I just read you a little synopsis. It's a book resulting from years. It's a 2005 book resulting from years of historical and psychological research by Dr. Joy DeGruy. PTSS describes a set of behaviors, beliefs, and actions associated with or related to multi-generational trauma experienced by African Americans that include but are not limited to undiagnosed and untreated post-traumatic stress disorder and enslaved Africans and their descendants. So PTSS persists that centuries of slavery in the United States, followed by systematic structural racism and oppression, including lynching, Jim Crow laws, and unwarranted mass incarceration, have resulted in multi-generational maladaptive behaviors which originated as survival strategies. And that's why I want to read, because that's important. A lot of the stress, a lot of the trauma that we carry is looked at as survival tactics, coping mechanisms and things. So, you know, basically think about on how black people get down on the weekends, right? Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we drinking, smoking, partying, being gluttonous, lustful, all these different things, right, on the weekends, right?
Mm-hmm.
You listening?
I said, I'm waiting for you, bro.
Oh,
keep going.
Man, you better say it like you mean it, but not. Nah. Anyway,
part, bro.
but that comes from a coping mechanism during slavery. Like, it's a story about a slave, a man who was enslaved in Jamaica, Samuel Sharp. One of the reasons their peaceful strike turned into a rebellion, a bloody rebellion, is because at first they were taking a strike or protesting their weekends being cut short and the holidays being taken from them, that off time being taken from them. So that off time that black people always use to decompress, but it was never but let's just be real though, to be fair, during slavery, there was no healthy means to help black people deal with trauma. So we never developed healthy ways to deal with trauma. So that's one of the reasons why PTSD and PTSS, the combination of those that are existing right now, still going back, that can culminate in suicide rates increasing over as the years go, because we still aren't necessarily dealing with these issues in a professional manner like we can. You know, there are more people who just want to talk to people about it or red table talks and things than to actually have sit downs with professionals. So, go ahead.
Well, that's because I feel like people have been groomed to believe that talking about it is enough. And, you know,
because that's
like,
what.
Go ahead.
That's what people are saying. That's like the ad that's in social media. Not that we have to talk about, put it on paper, let's talk. Well, who are you talking to?
Right. And that's the problem we got. That's the thing we have to deal with. Just talking about a problem is not going to fix that problem. Now, it might make dealing with the memories and emotions that come with thinking about that problem easier to deal with. But it's not going to fix the problem. There's still going to be things there. There's still going to be trauma there. So, you know, when you talk about stuff, you have to talk about stuff with people that understand and are able to progress you through the necessary steps for you to solve the problem and deal with the issue. I'm not even saying that has to be a professional. Obviously, we would definitely prefer that it be a professional, somebody that at least knows what they're doing. But if you have a really good friend who you feel confident can walk you through something, you know, and you're able to let them take those steps, even that's better than sitting there with it balled up while understanding that at some point, if you can get help, professional help, you should get professional help. In no way am I saying you should not get professional help.
Get professional help.
But what I am saying is that you can't just have a conversation about a traumatic experience and then leave it there and expect that to be enough to finish it. How many times have we all told a story about a traumatic incident, a big argument, a big fight, a blah, 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 something that happened to us, and then for the next 3 or 4 weeks, we just keep talking about that exact same incident? That's because we haven't really dealt with the emotional trauma of that incident. So we
right.
keep talking about it because that's all we know how to do. I just got to let it out. Well, you let it out the other day. Yeah, I just got to let it out. But you already let it out. But, I don't feel like I've let it all the way out. Now, you're right. You haven't let it all the way out because there are some other issues there that you need help dealing with. And so I feel like that's the problem. And I like what you guys were talking about in the last show, where you were talking about you got to be careful about having conversations and opening up these issues and then not being there to deal with the repercussions of what you just unleashed. You know, somebody might listen to a table talk, get riled up, go home riled up, and do something real foolish with the people in their home because they riled up. Something has been set loose, and there ain't nobody there to help them deal with what's been set loose. So when you start playing around with people's lives and people's emotions and people's mental states, that's not entertainment.
But that's another factor in the persistence of our mental health issues and our lack of real care for getting mental health, for our lack of real mental health care, I should say, because we want to find there's no easy way out of getting real mental health. There's no easy way out. You have to deal with your problems. You have to deal with yourself. You have to face yourself. That's the only way to get through it is facing yourself. And I encourage everybody to read Dr. Joy DeGruy's book, Post Traumatic Slave Syndrome. I have it. I read it. It's a good book. But these things that we're dealing with, like the trauma that you're dealing with, like one you talked about. Now, aside from racism and oppression, aside from that, the trauma that we would experience on a daily basis, depending on how you grow up. So, an environment that may have been conducive to me having fun could have been very traumatic for you. So, we went to Ricketts. If Ricketts is today the way it was when we were there, or before that, a lot more kids would commit suicide. Let's just be real, because of the way we existed around each other. I mean, like, you know, I told you a story about how I was in the classroom and, you know, me and dude was cracking and I said a lame joke and the whole classroom, including the teacher, got on me for about 20 minutes. Now, I could have went a whole bunch of ways with that, even though, you know, I'm a jokester, so it didn't bother me, but somebody else, I could have sent them off the edge. But it's still, I guess you could say, traditional things that we do, and tradition needs to change. I'm not saying we can't shoot the dozens. I'm not saying we can't do those things, because that's what black people do. But there's no substitute for real mental health. There's no substitute for real mental care. There's none. That's why we have a lot of the people in our black community who, when they face real traumatic situations, the mental health issues, the onset of mental health issues happens. A lot of people don't realize how homelessness and stress and all these other things can cause mental health issues. So just being able to look at those things outside of racism, like look at things within our community. We know what the baseline is, but within our community, what we do to ourselves, what we don't do for ourselves, those things that contribute to mental health issues.
And I want to real quick, before we move on, just clarify what I meant when I said it doesn't have to be somebody that's necessarily academically trained or you know, professionally certified. I have met, and I know I get disagreed with this all the time, especially by professional mental health people, because I guess maybe they feel like I'm taking a shot at their career field, and I'm not. But I have met a lot of people who have done the research, read the books, taken the you know, they've worked underneath people, they've been tutored, they've been in positions to ask the questions. They have the knowledge, but they don't necessarily have the academic credentials. In those situations, and I've seen those people at work. Granted, I haven't seen it very often, for, you know, being totally honest. I'm not trying to lead nobody to believe that these people are all over the place. But I have met two people in particular that I'm thinking of that if I'm having a mental health issue, I have no problem calling them up because I know that they know what they're doing, even though they aren't credentialed. So I think even to that, the space has to be opened up a little bit, because even to them, one of the approaches that I saw one of them use is an approach that I wouldn't think, that you probably wouldn't think to see in, you know, traditional therapy sessions. And there are a lot of outside-of-the-box things. So that's what I was getting at. But even in saying that, if you can get professional help from somebody that's certified and trained, Get professional help from somebody that's certified and trained, even if only because you're protected. If they screw up, if they mess you up, if they do something to you, you have recourse. If somebody
right.
that isn't trained and doesn't know what they're doing, but blah, 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 does something to you, you really don't have the same level of recourse. Not unless they presented themselves to be something that they weren't. But even in that, most people aren't going to present themselves in that regard. You might be leaning on a friend feeling like you're getting better, and your friend is fucking you up, not because they want to, but because they just don't know any better. So there are a lot of reasons why, and they far outstrip the reasons why you shouldn't, that you should go see a mental health professional, somebody that's been trained. But I did want to clarify what I meant by that, because I didn't want to just leave that floating out there in space and have people interpreting it whichever way they meant. So that's what I meant by that. But I'll say again, if you can get professionally trained, certified help, go get professionally trained and certified help. I'm done.
Ain't no shortcuts to a healthy mental state. There is no shortcuts. So that's just what it is, man. So our third topic is life expectancies, right? Mental health. Life expectancies for people with mental health issues, especially black people with mental health. And what made me want to talk about this is seeing the article about the man in, what it was, Galveston, Texas, who was led down the street by the police with the noose around his neck with the little rope and stuff, and the police was on the horse. Did you see that?
I saw a couple articles about it. I didn't actually see the clip.
Well, I didn't really see a clip, but I read articles about it, and I saw pictures and stuff. But turns out the man had mental health issues. But it also made me think about just black men, well, black people, period, because we've seen black women who had bad encounters with the police who had mental health issues where things happen. So, life expectancy for black people with mental health issues, because our encounters with racist white people don't end well. Our encounters with police don't end well. And our encounters with other people who don't give a shit about black people don't end well, especially if the person has a mental health issue. They're seen as an even bigger threat. So, I guess this is more about bringing awareness so we can start to make sure we have things in place to protect our people who have mental health issues. Like when I go to work, you know the corner store, man. You know the black people corner store. So it's a time saver corner store. And what scares me, man, two things that scares me about the people over there with mental health. This is one lady. She's in a wheelchair. She has like one leg. She has severe mental health issues. And she just ride her wheelchair in the middle of the street. And I'd be scared because I'd be like, damn, somebody going to hit her. But also, just not just that with her, with some of the men, when their interactions with the police, like, it could just go wrong. And then they can't really advocate for themselves. And that's one of the things that really scared me. Now, I'm looking at this article, and it was saying that Americans with major mental health issues die 14 to 32 years earlier than the general population. That's just average American. The average life expectancy of people with major mental illnesses range from 49 to 60 years of age. In the states they examined, a lifespan on par with many sub-Saharan African countries, including the Sudan. Average life expectancy in the United States is 77.9 years. So they're saying that on average, people with mental health issues, they don't live as long as other people. And it's all type of different factors, but especially a black person with mental health issues who may be homeless, or may not be homeless, but just, I just feel like they're a lot more vulnerable. Like, what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, there's been a couple studies that have shown that the stress of being black in America reduces the life expectancy of black people. And so it makes sense that the stress of having mental health issues, in addition to being a black person in America, are going to shorten your lifespan even more. So, you know, I believe the last study I read said that, and this was a study done back in 2012 or 13, that being black in America, dealing with racism, shortens your lifespan by up to 7 years. So 14 years for being having mental health issues also makes sense. We also know that black people experience mental health issues and deteriorating or age-related issues at a younger age than other groups of people. And I think all of that has to do with stress. And one of the things we have to understand is high levels of stress shortens the telomeres. And the telomeres are basically this end cap at the end of your chromosomes that prevent your chromosomes from blending with other chromosomes or from doing other things. And these things get shorter as you get older. The more a cell replicates, the shorter the telomeres get. And the older you get, the more your cells have replicated. So the effects of aging are largely believed to be associated with telomere length. And stress shortens these telomeres. So that's just the stress from being a black person. And we know that stress is a mental health condition. You know, like stress is an issue all on its own. Last Mental Health Awareness Month in August, I did a Lessons from the Screen show just on stress, what it was, what it causes, how it messes with you, all of these other things. So there's actually a biological component to stress and mental health issues shortening our lives. And there's, you can't really refute it. Like, it's there. Right,
it's
in
real.
Your face. It's real. Right. This ain't like I think I'm gonna live forever, so I am. No, this is a biological component that is shortening your life on a real and physical level by you living with this kind of stress. The stress of being black in America, the stress of the social situations that we're dealing with, the stress of the social pressures that we're facing.
So mental health will compound that.
Right.
Well, okay, and if you don't want to answer this, it's cool, but you have a son that has autism.
Right.
So do you sometimes worry about him when he's out doing his thing, going to school? Do you sometimes have worries about him making it back home with his encounters with his police, or what did you have to teach him? Or, you know, just kind of give us an idea. You as a parent with a son with autism, what are your thoughts, and what are some things you do to try to make sure your son comes back?
I mean, I talk a lot to them, all of them, about the world and what it means to be out there. And I do experience a lot of stress in that regard, especially since he had his encounter with the police that, to me and his mom, seemed like could have been the end of our son that day, because the police was asking him to do something and he got locked in a repetitive groove because he was nervous, and the police kept telling him to put his hands out of his pocket, and he was pulling his hands out of his pocket, but he would put his hands back in his pocket because he was nervous. And also, you know, the police was making statements about how he was he seemed standoffish, he seemed shy, he was real hesitant to speak, and the police made the assumption that he was under the influence of some kind of drug. My son was standing at the bus stop, and somebody called the cops because he was standing outside at the bus stop. Now, the bus had passed. My son didn't know the bus had passed, so he's just standing out there waiting on the bus. So,
it's a city bus?
No, it was the school bus.
Okay.
So this happened, I think my son was in like the seventh grade when this happened. You know, and he's going into the 10th now. But, you know, that was very nerve-wracking. You know, and we've had other incidents with the police. But I teach, you know, one of the things with dealing with an autistic kid is they're very literal. So that means that you really don't have to try to figure out how to say things in a way that they'll understand it. You can just say it and be blunt with it. And with my son anyways, and with a lot of other autistic kids that I've interacted with, the ones that operate on that very literal level, they don't do very well with context clues or subtle hints or things like that. You say what you mean, they understand that. So it's easy to communicate him in that regard, but it's real nerve-wracking to think that because of the way his mind operates, he could be put in a compromising situation through no fault of his own by a police officer or by somebody else that's misinterpreting what's going on. And we know that implicit bias is heavily to blame with a lot of the misinterpretations going on. Cops assuming that you're this type of figure, you're this type of person, and they see you doing this type of thing because of that bias, when in actuality, you're another type of person doing something totally different. That's how come black wallets turn into black guns in the eyes of police officers in stressful situations. So, you know, I deal with that stress, and I'm sure he deals with that stress. It is something that you worry about. It's something that he worries about. It's something that we all worry about. And it's something that, you know, the more digging I do into biology, mental health, things like that, trying to learn how to control my stress, trying to teach them how to control their stress, you do as a parent begin to be concerned that all of the things that are happening now are shaving years off my life and the lives of my children and the lives of my grandchildren who have not even been created yet. So, I don't know, somewhere in there I hope there was an answer to your question.
It was, because basically, you said you do worry, and you gave examples of why you worry because of interactions that your son have had with police. So it leads me to, even though it's grandiose ideas on our part, but it makes sense, police to start incorporating different things to help the officers recognize mental health issues. Because you can't just assume somebody's under the influence of something because they're operating differently. You know, there's a rise in mental health issues in America. Hell, a lot of these cops got mental health issues. But it just, what's interesting, though, is the over the last 8 months, I've gone to several different mental health programs. And every year it just amazes me the range of mental health issues that people deal with. So everything is there's nothing standard. You can't just look at somebody and be like, this person has a mental health issue or this person doesn't have a mental health issue, and people deal with them differently. And so that's what makes it this conversation important, but it nerve-wracking at the same time, knowing that there could be somebody who we could deem as perfectly normal, perfectly fine from the outside looking in because of the mental health issue that the person is dealing with and how it's manifesting within that person or how they're projecting the manifestations of it. But then that person get mistaken for something like under the influence of something different or nuisance or threat, and that person's life is ended. And it's just kind of scary because of a lack of information or lack of care to learn more information about mental health, especially from people who their job is to protect and serve.
Yeah, I mean, I think cops, if we're going into that direction for a brief moment, they definitely need a lot more training. They need better training, and they need better screening. I think all cops should be forced to take an implicit bias test before they join the force. You know, anybody that's showing extreme levels of implicit bias, one way or another, should be barred from entry, period, point blank, period. I think that's something that should be regularly done because we now have the testing and the ability to screen for implicit bias. We can now give you a 15 minute test that'll tell us everything about the way you see the world, and there is nothing you can do about it, even going in knowing what the test is testing for. So
now I can, but one of the things that, and I hear what you're saying, and I do agree, but even in this, and I should have said this, just thought about it as you said that, but even in that, even if the cop, I'm wondering, even if the cop does take the implicit bias test, the cop passed the implicit bias test, but some person sees a black person with a mental health issue become whatever, afraid, I would say, and afraid or whatever, call the police, and the police come out there with a preconceived notion of somebody being dangerous, and things go left, even if they pass the implicit bias test, because of the initial caller.
Right, well, that's what we get into, understanding the training. Cops should, at this point, there should be training already underway for every cop in America to respond to a call with a neutral state of mind. Because we know, and it's been documented, it's been proven far too often, white folk will use the cops to kill black folk that they don't like. We know this.
Right.
They will. That's how Crawford got killed in the Walmart. The white folk called the cops and told them that there's a black man in this Walmart with a weapon pointing it at people. And the cops showed up and they gunned him down in Walmart. Come to find out he was playing with a pellet gun that was on sale in Walmart. The cops were triggered. And there are plenty of other instances of cops being triggered like that. So at this point, cops need to be undergoing training, not only the implicit bias screening, and I think they should screen cops that are already on the force. And if they have extreme bias, they should be kicked off the force. But not only, and then there also needs to be regular screening and training to reduce implicit bias, because we know that these cops are only interacting with criminal elements, which means that over time they're going to develop a bias. So you got to counteract that too. But cops should be being trained to go into situations neutral. We understand we got a call about this compromised situation, but we're going
in. It may not be true.
Right. We're going in neutral because it may not be true. And the fact that these very simple things are not being implemented, insofar as I can see, and I do a lot of looking at what's going on with police forces, because in my opinion, they're public enemy number one to the black community. So I do a lot of looking into that, and the fact that you don't see anything happening on that level or in a broad spectrum, because I have seen stuff like that in a few small communities, but not on a large level. That lets me know that the cops really don't give a damn about doing anything, but that's a whole nother conversation about the cops. What is relevant and valid is the angle you present of them misperceiving or misconstruing what is, in fact, a mental health issue. And that's something that black people definitely have to contend with, because white people get the benefit of the doubt. When they, you know, if it's perceived that something's off about them, the assumption is automatically made that they may have a mental health issue.
But
when
not
black
for us.
People,
but see,
if something's off with us, the assumption is made that we're under the influence and we're dangerous.
Right. Right. But that goes back, that still goes back to propaganda that comes out from that Birth of a Nation movie, showing black man hopped up on cocaine. Talked about it a bit last week, but black man hopped up on cocaine going after white women. Like, even though everybody knows, everybody who's smart and can read and can understand what they read and have looked at the statistics know most of the things that white people are paranoid about black people, it's white people who are the leaders of that. But we still get the negative repercussions. But everything is heightened when the black person has a mental health issue, which then again goes back to the shortening of that person's lifespan. So that's why it's important for us to have these conversations. It's important for us to have this month, and it's important for black people to not just talk about it but take action, because we're dying, and we're dying at a fast rate, whether it's self-inflicted or whether it's from our enemy.
Right.
So we have to be able to look at this. That's one of the things that you're going to learn from this show, whether it's suicide rates within our community or black people being killed and their life being shortened because of their mental health episodes.
Right, and the key thing is we are dying, like you said. Mental health is real. We are dying. This ain't some think better, be better type shit. This is real. Stress is real. You can't just think stress away. And it is shortening our lives. And we do have serious things to contend with, because now, in addition to kids, our kids killing themselves through suicide, the stress placed on those children that don't kill themselves is still shortening their lives by years.
Yeah.
We got to alleviate that, because I'm not cool with accepting the fact that I'm going to die 7 years younger than I probably could have otherwise because of the stress of me being born black. And I don't want to think about the fact that my children and my grandchildren are going to deal with compounded stress on top of that, which is going to shorten years off their life. And, you know, any sort of child or black person that has mental health issues is potentially going to lose 10 to 14 years off their life. That, you know, like, that has to be unacceptable. So we've got to take steps to fix it. And I think one of those steps has to be the creation of true safe spaces. Another one of those steps has to be the acceptance of the necessity for these spaces and the utilization of these spaces, where we can go into these spaces and feel comfortable and not feel like, you know, we shouldn't be doing this or blah, 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 or any of those other things. I think that's step number one, is creating such spaces. Get mental health. Get help. Get professional help. And into that, we need more black people in the mental health field professionally. We really do. I'm trying to take up that coat of arms. I'm going to go back to school here soon to become a mental health professional. I'm trying to talk Joe into going back with me. But if we can focus on those two things, I don't want to give three things. I want to give two things. One thing, create a safe space. And that can be a space that's created in your home, a space where you're free to be you in all of your glory and all of your humanity and in all of your emotional turmoil. And then the second step, you know, I gave three. Step two, get help, period. Even if you think you're fine, go get help anyway. Get checked out. Maybe you're not fine. Maybe you've learned to cope with bullshit. You know what I'm saying? Maybe you've got some survival mechanisms that are actually supporting the trauma that you've experienced and allowing you to live with that trauma that you're going to pass down to your kids, and they're going to be all fucked up. Get help. Get checked out, even if you don't think you need help. And then if you are of the mind that you want to do something more, become a mental health professional and dedicate yourself to your community. Not saying you can't take clients from other communities, but dedicate yourself to really doing what you can for your community. Those three things, I think if we got more people doing those three things, we'd be in a better space.
It is, man. Hey, I ain't got nothing else to say after that. Close it out like a boss. But, you know, mental health is real. We got to make sure we take care of our mental health and quit the bull, because we have to. If we don't take care of us, nobody will, because don't nobody give a damn about us but us. So remember, this whole month of August is our Mental Health Awareness Month, so tune in. Next week we'll have Ms. Lashondra Kramote from Blue Lotus Consulting, mental health. She does a lot of mental health counseling and wellness things, so welcoming her to the podcast next Wednesday, so make sure y'all tune in for that. And then the fourth week will be a surprise. That's how it go down, but got to take care of our mental health. Remember, support Lessons from the Screen on Patreon at patreon.com/LFTS. Support the Fix Sports Podcast, patreon.com, The Fix. So check that out. Trying to see what else, any other announcements that I had to make. I don't think so. I think Pat already gave his parting shot, but, you know, he's going to say What you always say, though?
Power to the people.
Power to the people. Hey, let's get our minds right. Let's get our spirits right. Let's get our body right. If we don't take care of ourselves, we tripping. Two fingers in the air like a player, man. We just don't care. We out of here. Peace out.